comes from Dogen to study the self. Well, it's Dogen's formulation of it. He didn't say this is what we study in Zen, he just put words to it. So the exercise that I suggested for people last week was to look at themselves, because to study, you have to study yourself, and you have to become familiar with yourself in order to move beyond yourself and to realize, to find out what ingredients you have that you can bring to the supreme meal. And if you don't look at yourself and study these ingredients, then you won't know what to bring. You don't know what you have to work with. And so the idea was to look at, study yourself, look inside, and make a list of characteristics or traits that you saw in yourself without judging. So not saying these are good or these are bad, just saying, well, this is, you know, I'm stubborn, I'm self-righteous, I'm friendly, I'm funny, I'm serious, whatever the things were, without judging and without saying this is a good thing and this is a bad thing, or this is something I don't like about myself, this is something I like. To the best of your ability, that was the task. And then I suggested that people then post it in their comments. The idea is to share it then with someone else, because already sharing it helps us to let go of it even more. Already looking at it and not judging is a way of letting go of these attachments we have to these ideas about ourselves, our opinions about ourselves, concepts we have about ourselves. And already, so writing it down without judging it is already letting go to a certain extent. And then putting it out there for others, sharing it with someone, is also taking a step farther away from just keeping it to ourselves and holding tight to it. And then in Bernie Glassman's book, he even tells of in his Sangha, they would work, then they would, you know, there was a whole process they went through working with these traits and characteristics, and then people would be asked to draw a portrait of themselves using those characteristics, or draw a map of themselves using those characteristics, some visual thing that they could also present. Some portrait of themselves, however they saw it. So I suggested this on the blog, and what I said was, when we look, I think what you're referring to is, when we look into it and we do this, we can eventually get to the point where we see that these concepts we have about ourselves are just concepts we have about ourselves. That there's no, they're not based in any form of absolute reality. That they're just concepts, they're just ideas we have about ourselves. And we're not limited to that. Our identity is not that. And he gives an example of himself, saying that he tends to be very stubborn. And so at some points in his life, he could see that as a negative quality. Or people would say to him, you're stubborn, and they would accuse him of being stubborn and being stuck and holding on to things and whatever. And throughout his practice, whatever, he has come to see that that stubbornness also manifests as tenacity. So he can be tenacious in pursuing his work, whatever it is that he's trying to do. And in this case, it was to set up this whole mandala of activities around homeless people and drug addicts and people with AIDS and single-parent households with the mothers who couldn't work because they had to take care of the children and there was no daycare and whatever. So this whole mandala he set up, where he set up all these things. And he had this tenacious quality that allowed him to not drop it, to keep him in it. Which is another, you know, that was a facet of his stubbornness. So neither one of these qualities is necessarily good or bad. It always depends on what the situation is. And they're just concepts that are words that are put onto whatever is happening in this moment. So that's what that means. And what was, did you have a question about that?
I'm not quite sure what the question was. question is, it's more, I guess acceptance, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, so, how that, who the self, what this self is in relation to the other, how, in your relation with the other, you have two concepts, a lot of concepts facing each other, and you have to deal with your own way of seeing things, and even though you might deep down know it's only concepts, it still comes up, and you're still self-righteous, and you're still stubborn, and you're still this, and you're still that, and the other one in front of you also manifests whatever he is. And in those moments when there is friction, for example, it's friction, and it's just two confrontations of two selves holding on to what they believe they are and their what they think is right or wrong or at that specific moment, and knowing the fact that it's a concept in that moment, you forget it, and it's just how do you deal with that?
Well, the whole practice is about letting go, and looking deep, you know, looking into, and exploring yourself and other and all that. And where it's taking us, the path is to see through those concepts about ourselves and about the other. Even the fact, see through the concept of self and other. And when we say see, it's not intellectually seeing, it's experiential. And if we have had that experience, if we have that experience, we never forget it. It doesn't mean that the self-righteous or whatever the characteristic is doesn't come up. That's true. But because we've had that experience and we work on deepening it's an ongoing process. This, you know, as he says, the spirituality course is about experiencing the oneness. And it's not just something you do once and then that's it forever. It's constantly, constantly deepening that experience and renewing that experience. Right, exactly. And so then the more you do that, the less attachment there is. And the easier it is then when something does come up, self-righteousness or whatever it is, comes up, it becomes clear quickly and more easily that it's just an idea and we can let go of it and not have to go into it. You know, last night I was at this, you know, social gathering and someone was telling me, or he said to a little group of us, he said, you know, when I walk into a room, I'm always overcome by the impression, something like, you know, the impression that everyone is judging me in the way I look and the way I'm acting and the way I'm walking or something like that. And someone else said, oh, me, that never happens. And so I thought, wait a minute, you know, I don't believe it. I don't believe that the guy said, me, that never happens. But I know this guy who said that, and I know that he's in such deep denial about things like that. And his whole persona comes across that way, too. It's like he doesn't give a shit about anybody. You know, he's kind of full of himself in that sense. But I know that it's coming from this deep, probably way under all the denial, deep doubt, you know, that he's not even aware of. And the other guy, I know too, a fellow poet, was extremely sensitive. And I know that about him. Super, super sensitive. And also has, you know, like psychological issues that aren't like gav, but, you know, he deals with it. And so, you know, what I could say to both of them, I didn't because this was, you know, like chit-chat in a, you know, dinner party. But I can't remember what I said, but I think I said something like, well, everybody has different degrees of sensitivity to these things. You know, I said, oh yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I said, everyone has. And the other guy said, I don't get it at all. And so I said, well, everyone has different levels, different degrees of sensitivity, and reacts differently in situations, you know. But both of them were very attached to these ideas, you know. So if you're super sensitive, then you're going to be so aware and conscious of, or, you know, aware in the sense of all of these concepts you have about yourself are going to be so alive and so present, and you're so attached to them, and you believe them, you know? And if you're not paying, if you're like completely cut off, then you're not paying any attention to them all at all. But that's still having a concept, because you think that you are not that, or you think that you are something else. It's still just an idea. And neither one of them, I think the one who's told me that he, you know, who said, I feel this when I walk into a room, is maybe a little more in touch. He told me that he had done this mindfulness meditation training program for 8 weeks, and that he tries to do that regularly. And he says it helps him with his writing and whatever. And so I think he's a little more in touch with it than the other guy who, you know, meditation, are you kidding me? No way. You know, what? If, you know, I could relate to the guy about walking into a room and thinking people are judging me. But because I've done this for so long, I might still have that, but it would be for a fraction of a second, maybe, you know? And because I know that that's just an idea. And the idea of me, for first of all. And then, first of all, well, what judgments are just ideas, concepts. And they have more to say about the person for whom they are coming up than what they have to say about me. Unless I'm attached to my judgments about them, whatever, you see what I mean? But it's a constant practice. It's a constant, ongoing work. And the friction arises when they're, you know, attachments. It's like two walls with spikes coming out of them meeting, you know? And that's where the friction is. Of course. Because they're... All of these spikes are ideas and concepts, and then protective concepts. You know, there easily could have been a conflict between these two, although they know each other, you know? There could have been a conflict because it was such two polar opposite beliefs. And patterns of concepts or something. The whole thing is, though, just to study the self. And it goes on to say, forget the self. And when Bernie's translation of forgetting the self is that you become the universe. It's not about forgetting anything. It's like, it's about seeing things as they are. But in order to do that, you have to drop the concept of me. Just me. I'm this limited me. Who is shy, sensitive, afraid, never afraid, perfect, all-knowing, whatever. So in a situation like that that you're describing, what do you do?
In a situation of friction, you mean?
Yeah, like the situation you were describing, what would be...
Actually, the question came up from, not because of that, but I met with friends yesterday, girlfriends whom I hadn't seen in a while, and it was a lot about relationships, couple relationships, and one of them, and I was just, back. One of them is doing an analysis. She's not doing a psychoanalysis. She's been in therapy for a long time, and so she talks about that as well, and how it gives her tools to analyze situations and herself and the other. And I was just, my question came more from what I was hearing about how she was analyzing herself and the other. And just noting the in-depth in which she was going as to, digging in a different way that we dig when we sit on a cushion. And that was more what triggered my questioning now. Not that much the friction, because that was more contextual and whatever. But it was also in relation to how you look into yourself and different ways of looking into oneself. And sometimes I wonder if sitting and looking and realizing it's just concepts, you don't actually, you miss, you might not look, not that it's more shallow, but it's a different way of digging. I'm not sure I'm making any sense, but.
It is a very different way of dealing. It is. Mm. And I really like this guy, Joseph. No, thanks to Jack Kornfield, who's this long-time big name in American Buddhism, who studied in Southeast Asia in the 60s, and the whole insight meditation. I'm sure you've heard of it, no?
He wrote a book about kitchen or something?
After the ecstasy, the laundry or something?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. He's written other books too, but that's a famous one. And he's also a psychotherapist. And so he said, for him, I'm kind of paraphrasing it, but basically what he said was that for him, the psychotherapy work and the way of dealing and looking and the change that it brings, whatever, it's like, looking in your house, your room. It's like arranging the living room and getting the furniture that you want and seeing what furniture is there and what you don't need and getting it exactly comfortably like how you, so that you can live in it and you're comfortable there and you like it, the room, That for him, that's psychotherapy. And he said the Buddhist practice is, it shows you how to go out of the room.
Whoa.
Yeah. Now, which is better, and you need both, actually, right? Mm-hmm. I feel they're complementary. My experience through the practice that I've done and the different types of psychotherapy and long psychoanalysis, I feel they're complementary. And it's hard for me to say exactly what would have happened had I not done the therapy and analysis that I did, what would have happened in my practice. And it's hard for me to say what would have happened in my analysis and therapy had I not done practice. And I'm not so interested in trying to figure that out. But I do know that there is a difference, and yet there's a similarity. There's,
mm-hmm.
And I like his image of the room and arranging everything, because that's what it is with therapy. You become comfortable with yourself in a way that you aren't otherwise, because you let go of things and you analyze them deeply to see where they came from, and and then you change, that changes your relationship with your mother or whatever, stuff that you work on. But that's like, getting the couch that you like, or fixing the chair that wasn't working so well, and varnishing the table and putting in maybe a rug on that floor instead of leaving it bare, or whatever, whatever.
Mm.
Arranging the books and things. That's not all there is. At times when I was, in analysis, I sometimes would think, I feel like I'm like analyzing a sandcastle. You know, like doing an architectural art history study of a sandcastle. And that has no substance, you know. And at the same time, it was crucial to do it. It was absolutely essential to do it. It's like, you know, you have to go to the doctor to treat your body, and you have to maintain your body and wash and eat and take care of yourself, because that's your vehicle for this life. And in the same way, your mental health is the same way, same thing. You have to take care of it. And yet, it's not limited to that, is the thing. So.
All of this kind of has me wondering about the place of emotions, strong emotions. Because I think it's maybe easy as an exaggeration, but I can conceive of thinking about the ways I define myself and define others as being sort of illusory, like, I am kind. Well, am I fundamentally kind? You know, I am forgetful. Well, am I fundamentally forgetful? You know, things like that. Or this person is wrong, or this person is stubborn, and then kind of looking at it closer and saying, no, that's just an idea, and I don't have to stay attached to it, and it doesn't have to be that way, etc. But then I think where I get a little more lost is like, when I feel strong feelings of, you know, I guess they're strong feelings maybe attached to how I see myself, so maybe it's part of the same, but like, poor me, this thing isn't working, or, oh, you know, feeling disappointed by other people, or sad about situations, or frustrated, and trying to understand what to do with strong emotions, you know, should they be kind of regarded as just more illusions, more like this arises from a certain conception of myself, or this arises from an attachment to an expectation that was not fulfilled, or this, you know, or, you know, how do you embrace with them without believing them, I guess is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, and then that kind of brings me back to like the psychoanalysis idea of like, I felt this way in this situation, and you know, trying to uncover the roots and feel your way through it, but then at the same time being like, one strong gust of wind and the sandcastle turned into a pile. You know, it's all sort of illusory.
Hmm. Well, that is, in a sense, that's the key. And at the same time, so say, you know, today I was talking to someone, and we know someone who is completely disorganized and is always late, like chronically late. And but like really late, and like, you know, you're supposed to have dinner at 7, and he shows up at 5 to 7 with all the groceries and hasn't even started preparing, you know, and things like that. Or disorganized in the sense he's always losing stuff and he's missing trains and, you know, whatever. And so we both agreed that there was time when it drove us crazy. It was absolutely crazy, and frustrated and angry, and then therefore judging him and thinking he was stupid and incompetent and whatever, all this stuff. And then it became kind of a joke, you know, and so then no one ever took him seriously. But I think then we both kind of realized that our judgments and our frustration and our anger was just coming from our own ideas about how he should be, how things would be, should be, coming from our desire to control and have things a certain way. This doesn't mean that you just let go and go into his chaos. But it changes the way you respond then to what is arising. So it changes, and then your emotions are diffused as well, because you see that it's just your attachment to your belief about how things should be. Your belief that thinking he's doing it on purpose, you know, that he could be otherwise, but he's not. You know, he's not really paying attention or something. And so he's not listening when I say I have to leave at 7, so we should have dinner before. That didn't actually happen. I mean, that happened to someone else, but we see that if we look into it, you know, if we look into ourself and we see the illusion of self, then we see that all of our reactions are also, it's not that it's not happening.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
It's not that it's not happening.
So how do you deal with the fact that it is happening?
You see that what is happening has no substance. It has no basis. It's not some objective fact that I'm really annoyed by this guy and I'm angry at him. I have the choice to be angry or not.
But if you're already feeling it...
Well, so then you look at it and you say, where is that coming from? What is that? And you see that it's coming from your attachment to how you want things to be, how you want him to be, how you want to control him and his behavior and the situation. And the more that you do this practice and sit and really look and let go, you're sitting here on the cushion for 30 minutes, you're letting go. Every second, every breath, you're letting go. You're letting go. You're letting go. You're just letting things be, whatever they are. A judgment comes up about what's happening in this moment, and you let it go. And you train. That's what we're doing. We're training in this letting go. And therefore, when it arises, it becomes easier. But it happens kind of like à ton insu. You don't even realize that this is happening, that you've become more smooth. You know, it's like Roshi, my teacher, used to say that she could tell the difference between someone who had... She was talking about people who had lived with her in our community and people who hadn't. And she said, it's kind of like, it's not that there was better or worse, but she said, it's kind of like the people who have lived here and had all this friction that you have in a community and under the, you know, day-to-day eye of your teacher, training for 7 years, you know, in that situation. It's like a rock that becomes smooth. And if you haven't done that, it's kind of rough. And it's not one that's better than the other, but there's a difference. And during that time when you're doing that, you don't realize it. You can't see it. You know, you can't see that it's becoming smooth, more lisse, and that you are becoming smoother in these situations, even if the things still pop up.
So then the way you kind of come down on it is like, okay, I'm having this emotion, but this emotion is completely due to attachment to this or that thing, or to the way I perceive myself, or I perceive the other, or an expectation,
mm-hmm.
and therefore that saps some of the power of the emotion.
Absolutely. It's like something that as soon as you shine the light on it, it loses its power. It loses the power to overwhelm you. You know, it's as soon as it's no longer in the shadows. And because that's what the problem is. It's when it's lurking and then eating away at you or overwhelming you, that's when the problems are. Whereas if you bring it out in the open, you know, it's like I said, with writing it down and sharing with people, it doesn't have the same power anymore.
And so the shadows are kind of being rigid about it, being attached to it, being a certain way, being...
Mm-hmm. But the important thing is, where does that come from? Where does that being a certain way, that rigidity, that attachment, what is the origin of that? The attachment to the self. Because if there is no self, well then what's the problem? So what?
Well, you know? Let's go back to that conversation we were having, and So it seems what I felt was that when I did an analysis, but what I was hearing from the friend was that we were all talking about as if the problem was with the other. It was all about the other having the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me, and I said, and the one of the examples that was strong, but how do you deal with that? Because something did happen, and so for her husband, I guess is forgetful, for 1 year didn't pay one of the kids lunch at school, canteen. And they received a letter to home, and he was in charge of it. So she said, okay, well, now you take care of it. It's a lot of money. And she saw every day the letter, and she said, oh, he'll take care of it. Now, before she used to do things for him, and she said, well, I won't anymore. Let him deal with it. He'll deal with it. You know, she tried to be confident he'll deal with it, and he didn't. And as she's the one, I don't know what, she got the anti-démocrat. Because she had trusted that he would do it, and he didn't. And now she's stuck because she decided that she would trust him. And she's very mad, which is understandable. So how do you deal in such a situation? So if you took it as, if you look at your, I mean, if you, so that's what happened. And then you just have compassion for the other because his action probably reveals, I don't know, deep suffering and deep incapacity to I don't know what. And so the, you know, you're not I don't know how to go about it, but what do you do?
Like, you don't buy into the anger kind
of. Yeah, you don't, you just because there is something that you have to react to, because the situation is serious,
sure.
and has put
sure.
you in a very tough, you know, space.
Sure. Absolutely.
So you need to act on that, but
mm-hmm.
how do you act, but not act out of anger or whatever?
It might be appropriate. It might be appropriate to act out of anger, because anger is not necessarily, again, it's not good or bad,
mm-hmm.
anger. And there are moments when it is called for to be angry. You know, it depends. But is the anger coming from, where is that anger coming from? Is it a personal, am I attached to some idea about myself and the other, and therefore I'm expressing anger? Or is it coming from a compassionate place for the good of the child or something, you know? So the child can eat, and so that the family's finances can be... You know, I don't know, maybe there wasn't enough money to pay for it and that's why he didn't do it. I don't know.
There was.
Yeah, okay. Whatever, I mean, whatever the cause is. But it's not necessary. See, again, so that now we're putting judgments on when we shouldn't be angry. But that's not it either. It all is from where, what is the root of it? Where does it come from? And so in a situation like that, I don't know, and I'm certainly not going to give any advice because I don't know the situation. But... it could be possible, it sounds like it went from one extreme to another. One extreme of doing things for him all the time. Or doing, what did you say? She used to do things for him?
Yeah, she used, because he, yeah.
Is that something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, that's
to an opposite extreme of just putting the letter there and then that's it. He's going to do it. Whereas maybe that those are just two polar opposites, just staying in duality. Being attached to doing it or not doing it, where maybe there could have been a middle way of maybe this did happen, talking about it, setting up some, you know, saying like you have to do with kids sometimes, you say, well, there's a deadline, so take care of it by X date, and then if it's not taken care of by that date, well then you say, okay, well, what's going on, and you touch base again or something, I don't know, you know. Whenever we find ourselves going from one extreme to another, we're deeply attached to something there, instead of going, letting go and seeing, well, what is the appropriate thing in this situation? what's given all of the circumstances, the ingredients we have, what is the middle way? What is the right amount? So in one case it was too much, and in the other case it was too little. So what's the right amount of, and in a couple and parents and a situation like that, a family, you know, it takes two to tango. So it's not just one who's responsible for whatever it is. But
it seems necessary to me at some point to draw lines, even though they might be lines in the sand, and to say, listen, you know, I'm, again, not advising on your friend's situation, but, like, listen, you know, let's say, like, we're married, you cheated on me first time, apologized, we talked it through, then it happened again. You know, at some point, your actions toward me have been so disrespectful that I draw the line, and because there is a judgment in there, in a sense, like, of kind of, you've wronged me, and I've, this is a totally imaginary situation, so I don't know how to describe it exactly, but, you know, it seems complicated to me. How do you stand up for yourself and draw lines in the sand and determine this person is not good to have in my life, or at least not in this capacity, or this was clearly disrespectful and I shouldn't stand for it, without falling into the attachments? And how do you, on the other, if you push it toward the other end, how do you be compassionate and take each situation on its own merits, etc., but not become a complete doormat? Like, well, this time I imagine, you know, with the stress at work and blah, 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 and his secretary hit on him and he was drunk, and, you know, I don't know. I'm just...
But see, so again, this is you know, this is the two dualities again. And all of it is, it still comes down to the same root, that it isn't simple. That's true. It's not simple. It's complicated, human relations, and humans are complex, you know, machines or vessels, whatever you want to call it. At the same time, it's so much simpler and so much easier and clearer if you do the work and you look into and see into what is the nature of being, what is the nature of this. And then it all becomes so much easier and clearer. It doesn't make it simpler necessarily. I say easier. It can still be difficult.
Easier to bear, maybe?
I'm not sure that it's even about bearing, you know? It's about experiencing.
Less suffering, maybe.
Exactly, because pain, like we say, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. And we add the suffering on with our attachments. You know, you cut your hand or something, well, there's pain, of course. Someone hurts you, you know, they cheat on you or something, of course there's pain. But the suffering is like the victimhood, the accusations, the blaming, whatever you want to add on to it, everything that we add on to it. That is to not deny that there is pain. There is pain, and that's human. And there's nothing bad about that. But it's then, how do we deal with that? How do we experience it? And I guarantee you that if you look into and you see who is experiencing the pain, I mean, if you really see it, it changes everything. It changes everything. Who's experiencing the pain? Who is angry? Who is hearing the raindrops?
And the answer is no one, because we don't really...
The answer, I can't tell you. You can only find out for yourself. I could sit here and tell you all kinds of answers, but it would mean nothing. because you can only know it yourself. And it's not like anything that you think it is. So I can tell you it's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that. But you are the only ones who can know it. And like the name my teacher gave me, tu es cela. You are it. But it's not the you that you think. And it's not the it that you think. And it's not the are that you think. It's not think. You know? It's just another thought, what you think.
I'm still feeling kind of stuck in this moment of like there's been this hypothetical pain, which could be so many different kinds of pain. And then there is emotion, and there is, let's say, reason for action of, or reaction of some kind. But we don't want to compound the pain by adding suffering in a rigid, sort of predetermined reaction kind of way. And where do you go? Kind of feel like I'm on like the island of the pain, the hypothetical pain, like which way through or off this, like that doesn't just fall back on the same rigid ideas of self and other, and I don't know. Yeah. I guess it starts with accepting the pain for what it is, accepting that and not fighting and
absolutely, fighting. Not resisting, absolutely. Yeah. It's like that great story that I read in this book by Mark Epstein. It's a whole book about, you know, the cracks in our life or something. I forget what it's about. He's a psychiatrist and Buddhist practitioner in New York. He wrote this great book called Thoughts Without a Thinker. This book was about sorrow or something. And he tells this story about how him and his wife were having dinner with another couple, and he was telling about this group that he had been, group therapy or something that he had been working with. And I forget exactly what it was, but he said, well, samsara is enlightenment. This is something we, and then he was saying how through this group, or no, she was talking, she was the one in the group, but he was talking about what his latest book was about, and this was the book he was writing, you know. And they were asking him questions about it. And he said, he was telling the whole story. And he said, well, basically, you know, I'm trying to explain how it is that samsara is enlightenment. Samsara is delusion, illusion, right? It's like we were saying one night here when I think it was Guillaume who said something about, like, when I'm completely distracted is when I'm really here or something like that, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Well, if you're completely deluded, that's enlightenment. Okay, so I'm not going to go into that right now. But so the Sanskrit word for delusion is samsara. The world of illusion and delusion is samsara. And so he was telling this story, and the woman was from the other couple said, oh, you know, that's really interesting. I just realized something. And she started telling about this group that she had, this group therapy thing that she had been in, and that she had this anger that was coming up, but she wasn't able to express it. And then it made her really sad that she wasn't able to express this anger. And so she said, I felt such sorrow. And then what you just said, that some sorrow is enlightenment, and that changes everything for me. And he was like, wow. But she was actually realizing what he was saying. that when you allow it to be, you know, when you let it in, that is enlightenment. And when you no longer resist it, and that was the experience she was trying to tell, that by letting in the sorrow, it had changed everything about her day or weekend or whatever it was. And then she said, wow, you just, some sorrow is enlightenment.
Misunderstanding is understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. But I told this story in connection with that film, that was a Pixar film, Vice Versa, where there's the emotions.
Oh.
Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Did you hear when I told this story? Or no, maybe
I saw
the movie.
Yeah.
This is, you know, it's an animation movie where there's, you go inside this little girl and there's different emotions that are represented.
Yeah.
And sorrow gets, nobody wants sorrow to be around, right? And so she, for some, I don't remember what the how, but she gets shoved aside and lost. And everything is out of whack then. You know, nothing works. And the little girl, I forget what, she's doing weird things or something like that anyway. And or maybe it's because sorrow then, everything sorrow touches becomes sorrow
dies or something.
Yeah, everything dies. Yeah. You know, some weird thing like that, yeah. So they all want to get away. And so eventually, through the whole movie, finally they get her back. She comes back, but for some necessity, I don't remember why. And then they realize that the only way, you know, it's like the only whole heart is a broken heart. The only way that this little girl, the human, can be whole is to have all of these, they have to have some sorrow, you know? When I saw the movie, I thought of this story from Mark Epstein. I thought that was a great movie for little kids because you could understand it on different levels.
Not just for kids.
No, absolutely. No, that's what I meant. There were different levels. As an adult, you could go to it and understand something, and as a child, understand something. And at the same time, the message was the same. It was quite well done, actually. No, it was called Vice Versa, but here, but was that what it was called in...
No.
In American? Or?
No, so I can't remember, but it wasn't that.
So the...
Upside Down or Inside Out or...
Something, yeah, I don't remember. Mm. But it wasn't Vice Versa.
I think the original title is Vice Versa.
Okay.
I think.
I can't remember.
No, anyway.
It's time.
Okay. So, thank you. Want to do the...
Yeah.